From Seattle, Washington, to listeners around the world, this is Web Talk Radio.
Online security tips from Semantics Norton Group. New RSS content syndication book author, tech journalist, joins us from an old church in Italy. How to shop online like a pro. We're going to have some top tips. And Google launches Google Print Beta in its effort to index book excerpts from booksellers' databases. And we're going to cover our digital mailbag email from Harry, who says free PC offers may be making a comeback. I'm Rob Greenlee, and this is Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com.
We're thrilled you're joining us today. This is Dana Greenlee. Online shopping this year is up over 55% from last year. Millions of people are using and even trusting the internet and the web to do more and more of their shopping. But with this comes online security risks. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Craig Lane, Group Product Manager at Symantec. They're the makers of Norton computer security software products like Norton Antivirus. He's going to bring us up to speed on the current security threats online and some very good tips to keep your computer safe and secure from those worms, viruses, and hackers roaming the internet year-round looking for unsecured computers.
In the old days, the computer user had to take some type of action to install a virus or one of these Trojan horses. And now with some of these fast-spreading internet worms, the end user of the computer, the guy sitting right in front of that console, doesn't have to do anything. As long as his computer is on the internet, or just by visiting a web page and not even doing anything on the web page, one of these spywares can now be installed on your machine.
We are also going to be joined by Ben Hammersley, who is a European tech journalist and author of the new book, Content Syndication with RSS, published by O'Reilly. Ben calls us from a small church in Italy, and we'll discuss the current state of internet connectivity in Afghanistan, and we'll discuss his views on the growing future use of RSS content syndication that has been fueled by the fast growth of online blogging, and how search engines will be affected by the growth of RSS and blogs.
There's this almost transparent layer of infrastructure which has built itself up over the past few years, specifically in Kabul, where you've got people taking massive advantage of available information over the internet and using it within their own trade. You know, you've got carpet weavers in Kandahar who are trading carpets over eBay.
It's time for a brief summary of this week's web news and trends.
We wanted to share some shopping tips online since it's that time of the year, and we're certainly seeing a lot of shoppers online. One of the key tips is to, especially when you're visiting like a comparison shopping site like PriceGrabber.com or MySimon.com, is certainly use all the tools that are on that site and read the ratings and the reviews of the sellers, which would be the actual retailers too, which can be really helpful.
Don't forget to also look at the editorial reviews that back up the product's value. I used to actually write editorial reviews for Amazon's kitchen store. And, you know, they get to try the products and probably you can trust what they have to say.
And don't be swayed by hyper-emotional reviews that can be rather extreme. Just look for the general trend of the actual review of that product.
If your early warning system is going up about that online retailer, go to BBB.org. You guessed it, Better Business Bureau, website.
And also look for rebates. Some of the sites will allow you to directly link to them online as well.
Don't forget to check the coupons, the codes that sometimes you get in your email or other places. Mm-hmm. They have special bargain codes, and you can plug it in to get an extra, 5% off, free shipping, whatever.
And shopping online means that the prices that you'll see in these comparison shopping sites may not include shipping, but you can get some of that information from some of the comparison shopping sites just by entering your zip code, and they'll try and estimate the shipping costs. But some of them actually offer free shipping if you spend like $75 to $100. And also, since you've made a purchase and received the product, go back to that site that referred you and rate the seller yourself. And also, if you want to make a post about the experience that you've had with the product, I think it helps a lot of other people.
Well, first we had Amazon's recent wonderful announcement to search inside the book, and now Google has jumped on a similar bandwagon.
Well, it's similar in a way, but what they're doing is they're taking actual book content data from publishers and actually making it available in a database that refers to retailers that will offer that book for sale. So when you do a search for a particular book title, it'll pop up a Google page, and this page is coming off of a URL print.google.com. That's the key thing to actually look for. And what this page does is it just gives you the information about the book and links to places where you can buy it. Now, Google isn't making any money on this, so this is one of those areas that it's part of their Google Labs project. So if you want to go check it out, go to labs.google.com.
Let's open up that digital mailbag, Rob. We got one from Harry. He lives in Vancouver Island in Western Canada, not too far up north from where we are right now.
Yeah, he saw an article on CNN that was talking about how over in London there's a company that is launching, that's making available a free PC if you view some advertising, which I thought was an interesting idea. It's something that's been tried here in the U.S. but has failed, but that was also, I think, a little too premature. It was before broadband.
And these aren't cheap PCs, about $1,500 worth of a PC.
These are nice.
They're going
to
give out about 2,000 of them?
No, 200,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And what you have to do is you have to watch 1 minute of on-screen advertising for every 20 minutes of computer use. And what you do is you just get a CD from this company, like once every month or whatever, and you load it into the PC. And all these computers are going to have a full-time online high-speed connection to the internet. So they'll know when you don't load this little disk of advertising into your computer. They hope to have about 2 million households up and running with this in 3 years. And what they're hoping to do is to replace your computer every 3 years for you, as long as you view these ads.
If you want to learn more about that, the company that's supporting this is metronomy.com, metronomy.com. Rob, I also got another email this week from Bobby Barrasco. He's the founder and website owner of SillyEnglish.com, and he just simply said, need a laugh, you got to go check out SillyEnglish.com. He put it together along with other English as second language teachers from around the world. It's a nonprofit, just silly waste of time, to use his words. Bobby has some great, crazy videos on there. You definitely will enjoy the penguins falling into the water.
Yeah,
that's all
it's
I
definitely
need to say.
A funny sight, so go check it out.
And please, if you run into any interesting news like Harry did, an article, please send it on to us. We sometimes can't see everything. And if it's interesting to you, it's probably interesting to everybody else. Just email your thoughts or comments on what you've heard on the show or new ideas to either Dana@WebTalkGuys.com or RobG@WebTalkGuys.com. And we'll do our best to get your thoughts and comments and questions on the air.
Support for Web Talk Guys every week is provided by Compass Communications, a major international bandwidth, peering, and server colocation provider up in the Seattle area in the world-famous Westin Building, which is sitting right on top of the NET's gateway to Asia. So go visit ccom.net.
I also want to point out that we have several new sponsors of the show at the bottom of every page of our website. One that I wanted to point out this week was ADRC.net. They're in the data recovery service business. The company's name is Adroit Data Resource Center, and they help you recover damaged media. Maybe it's your hard disk, tapes, floppies, zip cartridges. And they also offer on their website a lot of emergency recovery tips. So if you run into a situation like that, go to check out ADRC.net and look at their tips on what you can do to probably try and recover it yourself. After the break, we'll have Craig Lane on the phone. He's Group Product Manager at Symantec. That's the makers of Norton computer security software products like the famous Norton antivirus and many others you have on your computer, more likely. He's going to bring us up to speed on the current security threats online.
Stay connected. This is Web Talk Radio.
We got one person online. The workload is enough for like 10 users. I think we got a hacker.
The Web Talk Guys.
Welcome back to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com. And thank you for listening. And I'm Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee is in here with me.
You betcha. Online holiday shopping this year has been up over 55% over last year. Millions of people are using the web. They feel like they can trust it more, and that's terrific. But with that trust and with more usage of online shopping comes some security risks for which you need to protect yourself. Symantec has put out some phenomenal software over the years, particularly in the Norton product group, and they've been kind enough to supply us with some software that we are going to give away on the show in the coming weeks. So definitely stay tuned, and in the new year, we'll have details on how you can win some great security software from Symantec.
We are joined now by Craig Lane, who's a group product manager for Symantec, the makers of Norton computer security software products like Norton Antivirus and many other well-known products for computers around the world. He's going to talk about the current security threats online that we all need to be aware of and some tips to have a very safe online shopping experience and to keep your computer safe and secure from those worms and viruses and hackers roaming the internet year-round looking for unsecured computers. Craig, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the real threats that online users face out there. And I know you guys are right in the mix of trying to be that defensive area on the PC to try and keep those things from happening. But what should internet users really be concerned about right now, especially during the holiday time when they're online shopping and giving out personal information?
In fact, this is a great time to think about security. A lot of people are thinking about online shopping, especially with some of the storms going through and just, the weather turning bad at this point. And I think at Christmas holidays, we're always looking for extra time. So what I always remind people is, the first thing is to use the same kind of common sense they use when they're shopping in physical stores. So if they're looking at a website, it's hard to find information. They can't find the privacy policy. They see lots of misspellings. The deal seems too good to be true.
Yeah.
I like to, at that point, move to a different site. Just like in a store, I would move to a different store if the store made me feel uncomfortable. And that also includes asking me for too much information. If I'm trying to buy a product and they're asking me where I live and a bunch of information that doesn't seem to be needed for the transaction, a lot of times I'll choose not to make that purchase there and go to a store that's not going to pry into my privacy.
Buyer beware, too, probably, right? And use some common sense.
Exactly. And then the other thing I like to remind people is, since the computer bad guys out there know that a lot of people are making transactions during the holidays, it's a great time to find credit card numbers and other personal information that's traveling around the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I remind people it's a good time to look at their general security protection, make sure it's up to date, and there's some new products out that can even provide them additional protection, both from software companies like Symantec, but also from their credit card companies that are coming up with interesting new services to make people feel more comfortable making web purchases, including single-use credit card numbers.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh, yeah, that's where you just have one credit card only used for online, a low limit, correct?
Well, there's that service. Another one is they'll actually issue just a number that is only active once. You type that into, let's say, your order form on an online site.
Oh.
That goes into your credit account, but that number can never be used again. So
oh.
If the bad guy rips it off and tries to make additional purchases, it comes up as an invalid credit card number. So that's why it's a single-use number that's tied to your account only once.
Wow.
So it's a neat new thing, and so I think there's lots of neat things that people that are cautious about getting on the internet can look into some of these services. In fact, our Norton Internet Security product has a neat feature that will help look for whenever their credit card information or social security number, different things that they feel are personal or confidential, it'll warn them when that's being sent from their computer. So if you're typing in an order form at an online shopping site, it'll say, hey, your credit card's being sent. You'll say, that's okay because I'm filling out an order form. If you're just browsing a website, checking out prices, or filling out email, and your credit card number is sent at that point, you can stop it. And that's how some of these spyware programs or the old Trojan horses will work.
Well, you mentioned spyware, and I just want to touch on that because this whole spyware, adware, and keystroke logging programs are kind of a new thing, at least to some of us. Why don't you explain a little bit about how those typically get on your computer?
In fact, that's an interesting point. Spyware is a topic that's getting a lot of new interest in it. And like you mentioned, the keystroke logging programs have been around for a while, normally attached to a Trojan horse, which was a program that was disguised as something that you might find valuable, would trick you into installing it, and then it would be doing something devious, sometimes in addition to what the whatever they were trying to entice you. So it'd have the valuable function along with a keystroke logger buried. In the old days, the computer user had to take some type of action to install a virus or one of these Trojan horses. And now with some of these fast-spreading internet worms, the end user of the computer, the guy sitting right in front of that console, doesn't have to do anything. As long as his computer is on the internet or just by visiting a web page and not even doing anything on the web page, one of these spywares can now be installed on your machine.
So is that only going to happen to your computer if you haven't applied security patches properly, and or can can it happen to computers that have been patched up properly?
Actually, well, depending on the infection mechanism, some of them will exploit some of these operating system or application vulnerabilities that you'll hear about from the security companies. Mm-hmm. And other times they'll just take advantage of things that will, the way that the web works, that will trick again a user into doing something. Or like I mentioned, this web page attack is you can actually go to a web page and they can actually download something to your machine clandestinely. And that's something that our security products look for and warn you about. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the Norton security products, we call those extended threats. And you mentioned like spyware we've been talking about. There's also another group of software that's really related called adware. And normally the real difference between those two programs are both trying to track your behavior or what you're doing. Mm-hmm. One you normally know about is an adware is embedded into a software product. It's normally a shareware product or something that's low cost. And part of the reason it's low cost is they're trading personal information about you for the low-cost software, similar to some of the grocery stores that have their clubs that will track what you're purchasing so they can sell that to advertisers, and in return they give you a discount on your groceries. In fact, that's something I always like to tell people is I use my private information like currency. So yeah. If I can trade somebody for information about myself, but I want something in return, what I don't like is to find people's hands in my pockets I don't know they're there. And that's what really spyware is. It's taking the concept of adware, but installing that piece of adware not the way you know, not in a way that you know about it, but in a way that you're not going to know about it, and it's going to start stealing your credit card information, your social security number, passwords that you might type in on your computer. So it's setting themselves up to do an identity theft for you.
When you actually talk about stealing a person's identity and their passwords and things like that, that script or that virus will actually look at your keystrokes and actually record that information and send it off to another server, right? So that's primarily how they would get your online private numbers and those kind of things. It's not necessarily that they're going to actually go search your hard drive to try and find that information.
Well, actually, there's ones that can do both.
Really?
There's most of the spyware falls into more the keystroke logger category, where they're going to try to watch you type it and just catch it on the way by.
Oh, okay.
There's others that will actually do things that will search for certain types of files that they know are valuable. So, in fact, Quicken files have been targeted lots in the past because it's a popular program a lot of people have, mm-hmm. and it contains lots of valuable information. So they'll actually search out Quicken files, and especially older versions that had less security in them, and especially yeah. people that don't encrypt their Quicken files, that makes it even easier. So if they'll actually search out, look to see if they can exploit that file, and if they can, they might even send that whole file along with their keystroke logging file.
Well,
and that allows the kind of bad guy to kind of inspect your Quicken file over days and maybe break into it, and it might not
okay.
be easy to do immediately while the keystroke logger is running.
Okay.
Now, I've heard about personal firewalls, and I know that that's really recommended. What are they, and why are they so important?
If I find that interesting is a lot of people are kind of scared of firewalls. It sounds techy or hard. It's really an easy concept, and it's something that was originally designed for apartment buildings. And it was a special wall that would keep a fire that started in one apartment building from spreading to all the other apartments in that same building. Same thing that's happening now on the Internet. If there's a fire burning out on the Internet, like one of these big worms spreading, the computer firewall will keep that fire out of the Internet from spreading inside to your computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really nice for the computers that are permanently on the Internet, like your DSL lines or your cable modem customers. Those guys, since their computers are on far more hours a day, really need that type of firewall. Mm-hmm. But even the people that are modem users now still need that. We find that these fast-spreading worms is if you're on for 10, 15 minutes just checking your email on a modem, that's enough time for one of these worms to see your computer and infect it.
Wow.
And by the way, I think in the past people thought, well, if I go to a cable modem or DSL, that's time to get a firewall. If I'm a modem user, I don't need that. And especially with like the Blaster occurrence or even SQL Slammer at the beginning of 2003, we saw that those worms can spread very quickly. Like I said, in less than 15 minutes of your computer being on, that's all it takes now to find it and infect it.
Our virus is going to get tougher and tougher for you guys to stop, you think?
I think I see another interesting trend going on is that, you know, to really write the virus or the worm, in fact, I kind of break it into two parts. There's a real technical part that takes a person that really understands computers to write, and that's the delivery mechanism of how does it find a machine on the internet and how does it infect it without you typing anything. That's pretty hard.
Yeah.
Now, the next step is something that a really lazy criminal can do is say, well, now that that technology is available, I can misuse it and I can attach a keystroke logger, which is a pretty simple program that they might be able to download off the internet, but then combine it with one of these advanced internet worms, and now they have a great way to steal. So I think I'm seeing technology kind of improving over time with smart people looking into how these types of programs might work. And some of those guys are good, some of them are bad. But then this next group, which is all bad guys, are leveraging that technology and then delivering bad things. And I think there's far more of those guys now that, in fact, like we saw with the blaster worm, it was interesting. The first worm came out, and then for the next few days, we saw new variants as sometimes high school kids would take that worm, change just a few things into it, allow it to deliver something else instead, and now they have a new worm.
Wow, that sounds really dangerous, I think.
Hey, Craig, we should talk a little bit about what Symantec Norton does for people to help protect them. And you guys use the term integrated security, and you have a full line of software. Why don't you touch on all the things that you can offer and what integrated security is?
Okay, that's a good question. I think most people are familiar with antivirus software. And in fact, we find that almost everybody has antivirus software installed on their computer. A lot of them might not have it up to date, and that's something that you should always try to keep your security software up to date. As we've been talking about, these things continue to evolve. They get nastier payloads inside of them and then better ways to deliver themselves. I think that updated content is extremely important. And we also talked about the firewall. We have a separate Norton personal firewall product that you can buy separately. But what I find is most people don't know the difference between an internet worm that might be protected with a firewall or a virus that you need traditional antivirus software. They just think of all of them as
one and the same, I would think. Yeah, exactly.
So I like to recommend people that they can buy this one box that we call Norton Internet Security that combines everything you need to be safe today. And it also includes not only security features like full antivirus protection, the full firewall software. It also has another technology called intrusion detection, which helps us catch threats that never touch certain parts of your computer. There's some new nasty threats that try to hide themselves from traditional protection technologies, and we can sniff those out using this kind of third leg of our stool called IDS. And then our internet security product also includes things that just make your time on the internet more enjoyable. So we also have the pop-up ad blocking and the spam protection that's normally available in our Norton anti-spam product. So for the Norton line, you can buy the features separately, so you can buy just the things you're interested in. Or like what I recommend is pick up the Norton internet security box. It's kind of what I like to tell people. It's our greatest hits album. So it's everything you really need. It's in one box. We make sure it all works together. The pieces talk to each other. And then you don't have to worry about which threat is going to attack your computer. You know you're covered from all of them.
So has the anti-spam package been really popular over the last 6 months?
Yeah, in fact, that's really taken off. And I think part of the reason for that is, you know, spam is very annoying. I had a 10-year-old son that he was using my email account as permission to get to a lot of websites. And so I had a tremendous spam problem, almost to the point where I was going to have to switch my email address, which is always a personal hassle.
Sure.
But just getting thousands of emails a day to the point that you can't find the ones you're looking for is also a hassle.
Yeah.
So the spam products, and especially I've been trying out the Norton Anti-Spam 2004, has really helped clean out that issue. I've been able to keep my same email address without having to endlessly keep going back to these companies begging to get off their list.
What is the process that the anti-spam software goes through? So does it actually get the emails and then sort it out and then pass it on to your client? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. We have a little kind of agent that sits in between your outside mailbox and the little inside mailbox inside your computer, and we expect messages as they pass through. And what we're looking for is a couple different things. We can look at different techniques that spam writers use and notice their messages, filter those out for you. And then we also use, in fact, what the terms are, we use a white and a blacklist. We start building a list of the blacklist, which is people that you don't want to have messages from or that are breaking messaging rules that normally the spam guys will fall into. And we also have a white list of people that we start generating that we know are good messages that should be coming through that filter. And then we also allow the person to interact with that. And so the program kind of gets used to how you're working. It's used to what type of messages that you like and don't like. And it gets smarter as it works over time.
Yeah, I was on your site the other day, and I noticed that you guys have a deep sight tool that basically tracks, I guess, threats all across the world on your site. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, in fact, I think that's one of the most valuable things Symantec has in its portfolio. Is, you know, as a security company, we have a huge research arm that looks for, you know, the new viruses and internet worms that are coming out. And one of the unique things that Symantec has is this service called DeepSight. And as you know, Symantec has both products destined for, you know, people using at their home and also big corporations that use our products. So we've been able to build sensors into many internet connections around the world, mm-hmm. and we can actually watch, and we're one of the first people that can see a new internet worm starting to spread or different types of hacker activities.
Yeah.
And we actually report that back into the security community, and then we use that to start our process to try to capture and to, you know, tear apart and build the protection for these new threats. So it helps give Symantec a really leg up on all the other security companies. And also gives us that valuable information that, in fact, we pass on to our corporate customers that let them plan their protection over the years better so they can see what's happening and get early warnings on things, especially for people that are running huge ISP networks or huge corporate networks. They need early warning about these internet worms that they can sometimes take protection that will protect everybody at the ISP.
Mm-hmm. Person can go to your site and download this plugin that'll actually report back to you guys what's going on?
We have a couple different ways. The way that your audience can participate is we have a little plugin that is available for free that a consumer can download and attach into their machine, and that'll actually make their personal computer plug into that deep site as one of the sensors.
Oh, that's
so it's kind of like becoming one of the Nielsen houses for the TV ratings. So we'll use
you
your computer to help us find out what threats are popular and which ones we should be focusing on to protect. And I always like to tell people that's a great way because it's a great way to make your threats the ones that Symantec is looking at.
Yeah.
It kind of makes you get a good vote into our system. And we also have higher price tools, as you can imagine, available to the internet service providers or to the huge multinational companies, because they actually use those reports internally also for different reasons. They can track how a virus moves through their company to let's say, find holes in their own personal security or corporate security.
Craig, well, thank you for joining us on the show. It was great speaking to you and finding out all about your great products.
Yeah, it's always fun to talk about them.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
We've been talking with Craig Lane. He's the Group Product Manager at Symantec, the makers of Norton Computer Security Software. Remember, we have some great products from Norton to give away, some antivirus, some pop-up blockers, and other great software. We'll be having a special contest coming up next month. Please keep listening to Web.Guys in future weeks. We'll talk more about that. Now, joining us in just a moment is Ben Hammersley, calling in from Italy, but Ben is English, and he's going to tell us about his adventures all over the world covering tech news and his new book on content syndication with RSS, published by O'Reilly. You're listening to Web Talk Guys Radio.
This is Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and thank you for joining us and tuning in today. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee is here on the other mic.
Indeed I am, and we're both thrilled to have the perfect English gentleman, Ben Hammersley, join us. And he's a European tech journalist, and he's the author of the book Content Syndication with RSS, which is published by O'Reilly.
Ben calls us from a small church in Italy, and he's going to talk about his travels to the internet-connected country of Afghanistan, surprisingly, and we will also talk about some predictions on the growing future use of RSS content syndication that has been fueled by the fast growth of online blogging and is changing how the internet helps people all over the world connect to information and communications more effectively than even the World Wide Web has, surprisingly. This RSS trend is even impacting how search engines like Google and Yahoo index information online.
Ben, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling in from Italy. Now, Ben, there's something I really want to know first off. For a guy who makes his living writing about technology, you find yourself in a lot of war zones and dangerous areas. Which are you, tech journalist or war correspondent?
It's kind of both, actually. It's a very good excuse. I've been a national newspaper technology journalist in the UK for 5 or 6 years now, and every 4 or 5 months I get extremely bored with technology coverage, as I'm sure you can appreciate.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I feel the need to go off and get shot at. And so every 4 or 5 months I'll go off and go to an interesting place, like, say, Afghanistan or Iran or wherever, on the basis that I can usually find a technology story in there somewhere. As you say, I was in Afghanistan last month, and I did a very big piece for my newspaper on the internet in Afghanistan. And last year I was in Iran for a couple of weeks and did a big story about the internet in Iran, and so on and so on and so on.
Are you really shot at those locations? Have you ever been in danger?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, there was a time a couple of years ago where I went to Burma and I interviewed Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the Nobel Prize winning head of the government opposition there. She wasn't under house arrest. She's under house arrest at the moment, but she was in between two periods of house arrest at the time. And she was being constantly followed, and I was followed and, you know, searched by the secret police and things like that.
Wow.
And just now when I was in Afghanistan, we were in places where it was all quite dodgy. But I'm 6'6" and tremendously English, if I want to be. And it tends to put people either at their ease or in such confusion that I can get away with just about anything. I mean, I take lots of photographs as well, and there's lots and lots of photographs of a very scary-looking men with guns who, after I've taken their photograph, usually buy me a cup of tea. There are very few nations who can do it, but certainly, speaking as a cliched Englishman living in Italy, I can quite happily sort of go up to a scary-looking man with a gun and say, "Hello! English, you know. How are you? Have you seen any football?" It's quite a terrible Victorian cliche, but it's absolutely true.
It's the charm.
Yeah, precisely. And specifically in places like Afghanistan and Iran and Burma as well, I guess, where they were either part of the British Empire or the British Army had invaded them before or something like that. And so there's this sort of a communal legend of this sort of, you know, the English gentleman, which obviously, you know, there is no such thing as the English gentleman, but there's a sort of communal cliche within that culture of the English gentleman. There is here in Italy, for example. You know, I'm taking Italian classes every morning, and, you know, I'm known around the school as the English gentleman. It's completely ridiculous because I'm sat here covered in a pair of jeans covered in paint from painting the house, and, you know, not as if I have tea, you know, I can't stand tea.
You don't like tea, but you're an English gentleman. Wow.
No, absolutely, yeah. Which confuses them even more. And in fact, they even think that's even more gentlemanly, because an English gentleman who's so delicate he doesn't like tea and drinks coffee must be a gentleman.
Yes, there you go.
And you can get away with just about anything by just going, yes, and sort of blathering at them.
Being 6'6" like you are certainly puts them in their place. I mean, when you walk up, I mean, I can totally relate. I'm 6'8" myself, so I can I totally understand that whole scariness when you walk up behind somebody that's really short and they turn around and, you know, it's almost like they get whiplash or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is that if you appear to be completely at ease, it's the old thing. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the writer Tom Wolfe used to live in Harlem in the 60s and the 70s, and he used to wear a white suit and white shoes and white socks and a white hat and a white coat and a white shirt and a white tie. Everything was white. And the theory was that he was completely safe living in Harlem in the 60s and the 70s wearing entirely white. Because the theory was that anybody seeing him wearing an entirely white suit in the middle of Harlem in the middle of the day or in the middle of the night even would consider that he was either completely mad or psychopathic. And therefore you wouldn't mess with him.
Which works to your advantage,
you know, yeah. Yeah, precisely, because you're thinking, he obviously knows something that I don't know. I'm not going to, you know. And it's the same thing when I've been to, you know, the more dubious parts of the Middle East, for example, where you can see this sort of doubt in people's eyes, even if people initially going to be hostile. We see this doubt in people's eyes where you see this sort of slightly floppy-haired, sort of slightly taller, slightly wider Hugh Grant figure sort of flopping down the street towards them. It doesn't quite fit into their worldview. And they're initially either slightly wary or decide that it's probably not worth starting a fight because obviously I know something they don't know. And then they get the kettle out. Yeah. It's good fun, and I wouldn't necessarily want to do it all the time, but it's very good, and it's very successful from the newspaper's point of view.
Oh, yeah, I think so. There's a lot going on over there, and there's a lot of fighting going on, so it's great
Absolutely.
That you're in there covering those things because they're
Absolutely, but there's also
things.
A lot of very good technology going on. I mean, the Kabul is particularly fascinating for this because they have better connectivity in Kabul now than they do in most of London, for example.
Really?
The thing that made Kabul such a dangerous city to be in when there was fighting going on around there is that it's surrounded by hills. Mm. It's just the same as here in France, actually. It's surrounded by hills. It's in a valley. And to be blunt about it, there's line of sight from the tops of the hills into the center of the city from anywhere you are, which is really, really, really bad if people are firing missiles down at you.
Well,
it's
yeah.
It's really, really, really good if you've got 802.11b equipment.
There's pluses and minuses to both sides, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so you've got... Now, people laying fiber around the city in order to build big towers on these hills, in order to fire wireless connections down into the center of the city. And I was sat in a cafe in Kabul a couple of months ago, patching my PowerBook, doing a sort of system upgrade, pulling down stuff at 500K.
Wow, that's good bandwidth for.
It's fantastic bandwidth
for that part of the world.
It's fantastic bandwidth for any part of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Never mind
yeah.
in a country in a war zone. It's actually quite interesting, and things like in Iran, the story I had there was the fact that Yahoo Chat, the most common nationality on Yahoo Chat is Iranian, and if you go into the Yahoo Chat audio chat rooms and the ordinary chat rooms, if you look at the their directory of chat rooms and list it by popularity, it's something like the first 10 pages, or at least it was a year ago, the first 10 pages of Yahoo chat rooms are all Persian chat rooms in popularity. And it's just because the internet chat rooms are completely uncensored and pseudo-anonymous. So you can talk about all sorts of things on there which you can't talk about in real life.
Oh, interesting.
And not politics, actually. They mostly just want to talk to girls. boys talk to girls and girls talk to boys without... the usual embarrassment of your aunt and older sister tagging along 10 yards behind you or whatever,
right.
Whatever the current social mores are.
So is it free broadband wireless access over there, or is there...
In Kabul, when I checked, there were 23 cyber cafes there, and it was $1 for 20 minutes.
Well, that's
is that expensive
that's pretty good.
In their economy?
It's massively expensive, yeah. But it depends what you mean by their economy. If you're an Afghan... If you're an average Afghan farmer, forget it. But the average Afghan farmer is not going to have a computer or a laptop or
exactly.
need to send email to, read /talk. whereas if you're one of the aid workers or if you're working for an aid agency or if you're one of the merchants, or the big deal specifically there at the moment is money changes. The money changes in the market in Kabul are the most sophisticated money changes in the world. You know, like Western Union money transfer,
mm-hmm.
where you can send money from one place to another in
sure.
15 minutes, whatever it is. The Kabuli money changers have had that system running privately to almost every city in the rest of the world for years. If you know where to go, you can go to basically any city, and you can say, I want to send, if I was in Kabul, you could go, I want to send $100 to Ben in Kabul, and you go to the right guy... And they would just send a fax to the person in the Kabul money market saying, we've received $100 for Ben Hammersley. When he turns up, he's this big English bloke. And then I go to the right guy in the money-changing market in Kabul, and I'll get the money straight away.
Wow.
And that used to be done by satellite phone and by satellite fax, and it's now done by email. But they have an immensely sophisticated system and immensely sophisticated, tracking money currency markets and such like. And these are guys who, if you saw them, if you stand 20 yards away and you can't see the power book, they look medieval. It looks like a completely medieval scene. But when you get close up to them, you realize that they've got sat phones and laptops and they're day trading. There's this almost transparent layer of infrastructure which has built itself up over the past 2 years, specifically in Kabul, where you've got people taking massive advantage of available information over the internet. and using it within their own trades. You know, you've got carpet weavers in Kandahar who are trading carpets over eBay, which is just crazy. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. That's just blows my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. It blows my mind completely. And I sat there and watched them do it. And, and things like, you know, in Vietnam, they've got people, villagers who live out right out in the middle of nowhere, who would walk for 8 hours with their harvest to get to the local market town in order to be able to trade their stuff. And sometimes they'd get there and find that the prices for whatever it was they were going to sell had dropped through the floor and they were going to lose all their money, or that it was raining and nobody was at the market, or that the road was down, or something was going to prevent them from making their order. And the fact that they didn't know this because there was no communications infrastructure meant that they lost all their livelihood. Whereas now you've got people setting up wireless internet links and battery-powered and solar-powered PCs, and you know, they can sell futures options on their, on their market produce.
Wow, interesting.
And this stuff is, I find this stuff totally fascinating, and it gives me a complete excuse to go off and, you know, wander around Kabul and, you know, run around Tehran or whatever. So it's a very good symbiotic relationship between my tech coverage and my need to wear khaki.
Oh, yeah.
Without a doubt, you have an adventurous life. We're in the middle of a conversation with Ben Hammersley. More with Ben in a moment. You're listening to Web Talk Guys Radio.
The real thing, a radio signal from another world.
I'm Rob Greenlee, and this is Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com. Dana Greenlee is in here with me, too.
And on the phone with us is Ben Hammersley, talking about technology in dangerous places and his work evangelizing RSS through his book, Content Syndication with RSS.
Why don't you talk a little bit about RSS? Now, I know you've written a book about it, and it seems to be a real hot thing on the web right now. And why is RSS so important?
Why is RSS so important? The reason it's become so popular, you can put down entirely to web blogging.
Mm-hmm.
RSS, for people who don't know what it is a collection of different data formats, but they all basically do the same thing. They enable you to, with an RSS reader application, to subscribe to mm-hmm. websites.
Mm-hmm.
And the weblogs are a particularly good example of this, or news sites. You would want to subscribe to sites which have very rapidly changing content.
Mm-hmm.
And you subscribe to the site, and your application will go out and pull down the RSS feed, it's known. It's just a file in this particular format, and that has the at the very minimum, it has the latest headlines and links to the articles that those headlines are correspond to, all the way through to a very, very rich feed, which will have not just the headlines, but it'll have the complete content in it. It'll have all sorts of interesting metadata and so on and so on. And subscribing to hundreds of sites like this is a very, 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 very good way of saving an awful lot of time.
Yeah.
Because beforehand, you would have to go to, you know, for example, I have over 250 subscriptions in my newsreader application. If I wanted to keep it on top of everything that people were saying on all those 250 sites. Every time I woke up in the morning, I have to go to each of these sites.
Exactly.
And then at lunchtime, I have to go to each of these sites, and then again in the afternoon. And, you know, it would take up my entire day. Whereas now I can just subscribe to them in the application. The application refreshes itself every few hours, shows me the latest things that people have written, and then I can get on with the rest of my work. It at its very basic level, it adds an enormous amount of productivity to your life. And it's more advanced level from a information architecture point of view, do some really, really, really clever things with the feed other than just displaying it and looking at it.
Certainly there's been a lot of discussion, you know, that I've heard online and things about the RSS technology being used for all sorts of different things, like a possible replacement for email or more peer-to-peer type communications as spam, you know, gets bad out there. And do you see this technology moving into some of those other areas? Because it's certainly capable of doing those things, right?
It's definitely going to move into lots of areas. I don't think it's going to be an email replacement. There was a lot of talk about this, where the idea was that you would, instead of sending email to somebody, if you had a personal relationship with somebody and you were going to be swapping email all the time, what you would do is you would each subscribe to the other person's special feed.
Yeah.
And instead of sending them an email, you just put a message onto this feed, and then the feed would be refreshed and you'd see it. This has a huge disadvantage in that, I don't know about you, but certainly for me, the vast majority of email I get is from people I don't know already.
Yeah.
This would prevent that sort of conversation from happening. I can already whitelist in my email application. I can already say only receive stuff from people in my address book. But that doesn't really, and that would stop all of my spam, but it would also stop all of my, all of my interesting conversations. So I can't really see RSS being used in that particular way. But certainly there are a lot of lots of other very, very interesting uses of RSS. There are many different versions, and there's a whole long story about why there are so many different versions. But version 1.0, which is based on RDF, which is the data format around which the semantic web is being built, enables you to place an enormous amount of metadata into the feed. And this, in turn, enables you to do some very, very clever things with searching. Mm-hmm. I've just been working with Nature magazine, which is a big scientific publication here in Europe, but in the UK. And they have a lot of scientific publications, and they're publishing all of their articles as RSS, but with enormous amounts of metadata in the background, you know, not just the name of the author, but also all of the people the authors work with, all of the different subject matters, all the different keywords, and so on and so on. And then they've built an RSS-based search engine, which enables scientists to subscribe to produce customized feeds, where in their newsreader they'll be able to say, okay, my specialist subject is raspberry breeding. Show me everything that's published anywhere by these publishers on raspberry breeding. And also show me everything that's ever been published by all of the people that I've ever worked with. And also show me all of the stuff that's been published by all of the people who've worked with the people that I've worked with and who live within 50 miles of my town, and that sort of thing. And this sort of RSS enables this sort of customized publication and customized reading to happen. And that's, a lot of people are seeing that as a very, 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 very powerful tool for knowledge management and for academia specifically.
So what kind of things are we going to see in the future? I mean, it almost sounds like this is almost like a search engine type technology to be able to enable people to find the information, detailed content. Where's this going? What's your vision of the future of the implementation of this? Where are we going to see it? I know I've heard some discussion about the new Windows OS Longhorn to enable display this, but the Windows OS has had that capability in the past, and they kind of dropped it, but things have changed since then, I know.
Absolutely. Well, the main thing that's changed is that certainly by when Longhorn comes out, well, they're saying 2006, so we can take it to 2008, I guess. When Longhorn comes out, you can assume that the user will have broadband access to the internet all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when Windows had Active Desktop, which was their previous attempt at it, you couldn't assume that. And the very best that you could really assume was they might have a 56K modem connection every so often. And so the refreshing, the pulling down of the new feeds, just doesn't really happen. Whereas now you can assume that. And so my personal view is that for content-heavy sites, things like news sites, weblogs, technical publications, that sort of thing, you'll be publishing it in two different formats. You'll be publishing it in XHTML, which will look lovely in a browser and look lovely on a mobile device, look lovely on a television, whatever. And it'll be perfect for human consumption. And you'll publish it as RSS, which will be for machine consumption. That'll be consumed by more sophisticated search engines. It'll be consumed by aggregators who take the feeds from lots and lots of different sources and enable you to make another feed which chooses the things from all of these different sources that you're interested in. It'll be used by intelligent agents. It'll be used by lots of different programs rather than humans. The thing of taking an RSS feed and displaying it on the screen is incredibly trivial to do. And which is why the taking an RSS feed and displaying it on the desktop, like they did in the Longhorn demonstration the other day, wasn't particularly exciting for anybody, because it is quite literally four lines of Perl to do that.
Yeah, it's not very complicated, that's for sure.
It's not very complicated, absolutely. But the complicated stuff and the really interesting stuff is taking all of these feeds and adding them together and then pulling out inferences from them.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in RSS, again, you can start embedding what's called the friend of a friend vocabulary, which is a way to describe the people that you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you've got hundreds of feeds each describing the people that the author knows, you could place those into an application, which would then start to be able to create a social map.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could say, okay, show me all of the articles written today by everybody I know. Or show me all the articles written today by everybody I know and everybody that they know.
Uh-huh.
Or show me all the articles written in the past week by people who like the same music as I do. Or show me everything that's been written in the past day by somebody who lives in my hometown. Or that sort of fine filtering for reconsumption is a really, really powerful idea. And it's a very, very useful thing, not just in terms of general web blogging and just reading stuff on the web, but for use by, say, corporations. RSS is being used a lot by corporations internally because inside larger organizations, you need to get news from one department to another. You don't want, as a departmental head, you don't want to spend a budget on building an internal website and then, you know, sending memos around where everybody is saying, come and look at my website because this is where the latest prices are, or this is where the latest system status is, or this is where the latest delivery times are, or whatever. You don't want to do that. It's too much hassle. But what you could do is just publish an RSS feed.
One last question I wanted to ask you.
Right.
Google has, you know, here in the last year or so, they've acquired Blogger. What do you see as Google's thinking on making an acquisition of a Blogger type technology? What do they have on their plate for the future here? What are they thinking about?
Oh, if I knew that. to be honest with you, I remember that day very well because it happened in the evening, I think, your time. So it was sort of very early morning. I was in London, and it was very, very early morning. And so we all woke up to a frenzy of instant messaging and emailing and sort of ICQ and such like, an IRC of people saying, oh, Google's bought Blogger. What? Why? And I had phone calls from all my editors saying, you know, what's going on? The conclusion that we came to, and the conclusion I stick by, there are two reasons, I think, that they bought Blogger. The first one was that it's an incredibly clever play to take the Blogger software and place it in their Google appliance, which they're selling into corporate organizations.
It's
a very nice little add-on to the Google appliance.
Sure.
The second, and what I fear is actually probably the most likely reason that I can think of, is just because they could.
Okay.
Blogger is really cool. Historically, they've never had any money. They've always worried about money. Life without, you know, the internet without Blogger would be infinitely poorer, and Google has got enormous amounts of cash. My general thought was that they realized they could do some good in the world, and they did it, and then spent the next few months looking around for a reason for having done it.
Mm-hmm.
And undoubtedly, they will find some very good reasons for having done it, but I think that I have no proof of this, but my feeling is that at the time they did it just because they could, which is why this sort of the Google IPO thing makes me slightly sad,
mm-hmm.
is that they won't be able to do that anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And also there's been talk that Google could ultimately use those millions of bloggers as a content resource, but there's also been some controversy about people not wanting to have those blog results show up in the general search results and to have a separate, you know, kind of like a separate search channel for blog content.
Yes, absolutely. Blogger have come, Google have come out and categorically stated that this is not going to be the case ever. And I can see why they would say that, basically, because I don't know how you can systematically tell what's a blog and what isn't.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people there are a few people, a few very vocal people who are slightly upset with the fact that due to their very, very interlinked nature of weblogs, the weblog community, and specifically the tech weblog community, can take over the Google ranking of certain words.
I mean,
for example, if you search for the word Ben on Google, I'm usually either the second or the third Ben in the world, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, you know, it is.
I'm fighting it out with there's me and Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And you know, it's a death match. And you know, the bearded ones have got it coming, I swear. But hang on, I've got my laptop here and it's online. Let's find out who is number one today. It is Ben and Jerry's, and I'm second.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, you've got your work cut out for you, don't you?
I have. But what I don't understand is who's linking to Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah, that's true.
This is worrying me. But you see, so this is like, I mean, this is crazy because, you know, I'm vaguely well-known in my field, but I'm not I shouldn't be well known enough to be the second most popular Ben in the universe, according to Google. it's very nice that I am, but you know, I might have a T-shirt printed up or something. But
yeah.
it's me above Ben Franklin's Guide to the U.S. Government for Kids, above the Ben Gurion University of the Negev. You know, it's just ridiculous.
What does that say about your importance, though? I mean, you must be a pretty important guy to rank that high, right?
Well, either that or the fact that I just happen to have been blogging for a few years and an awful lot of people have linked to my site.
There you go.
And that's why a lot of people get quite upset about the idea that PageRank, which is the name of the thing that Google uses to rank that search results, a lot of people say that PageRank is broken because it enables the effect that I can be the second Ben in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I totally disagree with this in that PageRank... Yes, okay, that's really bad, but PageRank works brilliantly for 99.99999% of the time. And until somebody can come up with a ranking algorithm which somehow, you know, reads the pages and decides their inherent worth, we're kind of, you know, PageRank is the best we've got. You know, if 300 bloggers link to something and change the meaning of a word within Google...
Yeah.
Who's to say that they're wrong? I mean, who's to make that judgment? Certainly, it can't be done by a machine, and I don't think it can be done by a person either. So I think we're kind of always going to be stuck with this problem until somebody else can work out a better.
Yeah, I think that there's been talk about having page popularity as being that, but in some ways, PageRank is page popularity. So
absolutely, yeah. And also page popularity is. Page popularity is not, you know, popularity is not a judge of quality.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you only have to watch, you only have to watch American television news to judge that.
Yeah.
So,
what are you really saying there? No.
Well, I can think of a couple of, and I'd like to still work for those news organizations.
Yeah, I know.
So
what you're
can't really name them, but I can think of a couple of channels who are incredibly popular who I wouldn't count as being particularly. Voracious reporting, and I can also point you to quite a few good, extremely good news magazines, which are bought by a readership of a fifth of that. So I think page popularity doesn't really work.
Yeah.
And indeed, it doesn't. You can see that it doesn't work in the fact that people use Google rather than say Yahoo or Google rather than a lot of there were a lot of commercial search engines that's launched.
Sure.
In Europe a couple of years ago where there were things called like top 50 and things like that where they'd only have 50 results for every for every category because they would say that we've sent humans out to find it for you and these are the best ones. Just trust us. These are the best ones.
Well, it's Yahoo Directory is what you're really talking about there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it turns out that it's not.
Yeah. And that's not the holy grail of search.
No. And also, how would they ever find out how popular these things are?
Yeah.
You know, people lie.
That's true. They'll do anything to get up in the top of the search engines. Yeah,
absolutely. And and if truth be really told, the most if you were to do site popularity, the vast majority of the hump in the middle, to create a terrible pun, would be porn sites.
Yeah, that's
so. You don't want to get you don't. I can't think, and I've given it a lot of thought. I can't think of a better alternative to PageRank and. And that, certain terms are taken over by the blogging community, is just kind of too bad. And it's actually really just a sign of that the internet is still growing in its sophistication. And undoubtedly, in 50 years' time or 100 years' time, when the internet has become much more socially inclusive, much more intellectually important, then I won't be the second Ben in the universe.
Yeah, it's a sad day for you, though.
Well, it will be a sad day. Yes, quite tragic. But it's always quite good because, you know, people say, well, how can I get in touch with you? Just search me on Google.
Yeah.
What's your second name? Doesn't matter.
just type in Ben, right?
Just put in Ben, you'll see it. There I am. You know, precisely. Everybody has to remember that the net's only been popular. The web has only been popular for 5 years.
Yeah, it's been...
And it's only really been usable for... Two or three.
Yeah.
Really?
That's true. You know, especially with broadband connectivity, it's really, that's really when the web is really going to come into its own.
Absolutely. Yeah. And although it's lovely to be able to think back to, you know, the days of Netscape 2 and, you know, the fish cam and the, you know, cool sight of the day and all of that sort of stuff, which I can get very nostalgic about. But when it, you know, when it was, you know, a small community and it was only 250,000 people, and you could, Yahoo could employ a couple of hundred students to sit there and catalog everything, then yeah, but now, what is it, 5 billion pages and 600 million users and in 150 different languages, and
yeah, I mean it's
just in that period where it's not the audience is a very rounded audience, but the content isn't as rounded as the audience is.
Yeah, and that's one of the core reasons why RSS is starting to be so popular right now, is that it's kind of a filtering tool, isn't it? To try and get narrowed down to what you're looking for and make it easy to get to it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it enables you to once you've found the stuff that you're looking for, to keep track of it. Excuse me.
This is a message from dogpile.com.
That my two semantic greyhounds.
Yeah, I think we have a new guest on the show.
We do. Young Pico here, who's very famous. When I ever give speeches, he's on all of the slides.
Oh, he is?
He's a semantic dog.
He's
a semantic dog, because the easiest way to explain the semantic web, which is a very technical subject, the easiest way to explain this is to give a very, very common analogy, and the very common analogy is, this is a dog.
Fetch, right?
Well, precisely.
Fetch here, get that? Yeah. I understand. Yeah. Well, Ben, thank you for joining us. It was great speaking with you. We got to wrap it up at some point here, but you know, unfortunately, we could go on probably for hours to talk about your adventures and what's going on with the web. And
sure. Well, anytime.
Well, we certainly appreciate it, and we wish you luck out there in the battlefields of Europe and all over the world.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for Web Talk Radio this week. On behalf of Rob and myself, thanks for listening, and we'll see you round the net.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.